This is White Collared, Season 3, Episode 2, Where There's a Will. Thank you for joining me for this, another episode of White Collared, which is a retrospective commentary on the USA Network television series, White Collar. My name is Eric Altenglenn Hilliard. Where There's a Will first aired on June 14th, 2011. It was written by Mark Goffman and directed by Sanford Bookstaver. An eccentric millionaire leaves estranged brothers conflicting versions of their late father's will, each will leaving the entire estate to the respective brother. When each claims to have the authentic will and accuses the other of having resorted to forgery, Peter and Neil are called in. But not only are both wills forgeries, it turns out that they may actually be part of a treasure hunt that could lead them to the genuine will and their late father's fortune. But the treasure hunt takes a dark turn when the daughter of one of the brothers is kidnapped. The ransom, the unaccounted for inheritance. In the meantime, Mozzie is eager to sell off some of the plunder he stole from Vincent Adler and the recovered Nazi sub, but an art crimes investigator brought in by Peter threatens that plan. The episode begins with Peter and Neil arriving at the estate of the late Nathaniel Roland. His sons, brothers Josh and James, each have a copy of Roland's will. Or they believe they do. One copy leaves the entire estate to Josh, the other leaves the entire estate to James. Each brother, of course, believes that theirs is the genuine will, and that the will that the brother has is a forgery. So, the FBI has requested that Neil look at the wills to try to determine which is genuine and which is forged. As they are making their way inside, Peter and Neil are talking about the case, although at this point, it really doesn't seem to be much of a case. It really seems to be more of them doing someone else a favor. And Neil manages to hurt Peter's feelings somewhat by suggesting that since the Bureau had requested Neil identify the forgery and authenticate the real will, but hadn't mentioned Peter, well, Peter is somewhat irrelevant at the moment. Inside the mansion's large and elegant dining room, they're greeted by Brother Josh. They introduce themselves, with Peter mentioning that he's not relevant at the moment, but he will be soon. And Josh is a well-dressed guy. I mean, he's in a suit, a tie. He's the image of a proper and refined and somewhat stuffy young gentleman. After he directs Neil to the two competing wills that are lying on the large table in the center of the room, he tells Neil that he really doesn't want his brother to go to jail over the disagreement and the possible forgery, but he says if his brother is trying to steal $40 million, and he leaves the sentence unfinished, but the unspoken implication is clear. Although he may not want his brother to go to jail over the matter, he's willing to let it happen just so long as his brother doesn't get the money. Not a sign of a good relationship, at least not starting out that way. A moment later, Brother James appears carrying his young daughter, Savannah. He apologizes for being late, saying that his daughter's nap went longer than expected, to which Savannah says, "I didn't take a nap." James shushes her, suggesting that maybe Brother James is not a totally honest person. Savannah heads over to the couch where Peter, still feeling irrelevant at the moment, is sitting, and she joins him. The brothers begin taking verbal jabs at each other, and it's pretty typical for brothers to argue. They take pleasure in teasing or tormenting the other, so the relationship portrayed here is probably not foreign to anyone who has a brother. But in this particular case, this may have been more realistic and easy for the two actors to play, because the two actors playing the brothers actually are brothers. They're Christopher and Danny Masterson. Clever bit of casting that. Well, the brothers calm down, and Neil sits down at the table to begin examining the competing wills. As this is happening, Peter and Savannah are talking, with Savannah asking about Neil and his anklet. Peter begins to explain it to her in boring adult detail, but realizes that the details don't matter. He just gives up and simply says, "It's so I don't lose him." Savannah shows Peter the anklet that she wears, saying that she got it from her grandfather. Back at the table, Neil has examined each of the two wills presented by each of the two brothers. And he has some news.
This is a forgery.
So is this one.
They're both forged?
Yeah.
How can you say they're both fake?
The witness signatures, the velocity, acceleration, and pressure both have exactly the same anomalies. They were signed by the same person.
So what happens now?
Before we jump to any conclusions, we'll run a couple more tests. When we get something,
We'll let you know.
Okay, so that's interesting. And both brothers are understandably perplexed, as is Peter. Of course, this raises many questions. First being, where is the real Will? Or is there a real Will? And how did the brothers manage to manufacture their respective forgeries, if they did, in fact, manufacture them themselves, with each of them using the same individuals as witnesses, but those same individuals as witnesses signing two different names on two different wills? Of course, the rational explanation is that both of them have been duplicated by someone, although at this point, that explanation has not apparently occurred to anyone. So instead of trying to resolve the issue, try and figure out what's going on, everybody just walks away, proverbially scratching their heads. Later that evening, Neil arrives back at the apartment. Mozzie's waiting for him, arm resting on a box that's sitting on the dining table. And with a bit of fanfare, Mozzie lifts the box, revealing a computer. Mozzie has rigged up a treasure cam. This way, they can both keep an eye on their treasure without actually having to go physically check on it. Not a bad idea. After all, the less they have in the way of direct contact with it, the less likely it is that somebody's going to find it by following them. As Neil is appreciating the gesture, Mozzie points out the Degas painting, which is in clear view, stating that he thinks he's got a buyer for it. As the conversation progresses, Mozzie asks Neil if he's picked out a new name. Neil says, close, to which Mozzie says, Glenn Close, which of course is the name of an American actress who's appeared in numerous diverse films such as The Natural, Fatal Attraction, 101 Dalmatians, and Guardians of the Galaxy. But Neil clarifies, no, I didn't mean the name is close. I mean, I'm close to picking a name, saying that he might have to live with his next one till the end, and that he wants to make sure it feels as good as Neil Caffrey, which suggests that Neil Caffrey may not even be his real name. Now, although that may seem like a stretch, if you think back, we've never actually gotten any direct statement from Neil that I can recall that Neil Caffrey is his real name. We have assumed it is, based on the evidence that we have. Peter has assumed that it is, based on the evidence that he has. But given Neil's skill at forging documents, this could be one of his earlier aliases. He could have forged all the necessary documents to establish this as his primary identity, as opposed to his real identity. And if this was one of his earlier ones, it could appear that this is his real name, even when it isn't. But anyway, that's all kind of beside the point at the moment. Next, we have a time jump to the next day, and we are in Peter's office at the FBI. Peter tells Neil that the biometrics confirm that the witness signatures were forged, and Neil makes a sarcastic comment about, well, he could have told Peter that. Oh, wait, he did. Peter ignores Neil's sarcasm, saying that based on Neil's initial conclusions, the FBI lab ran additional tests and checks on the will and discovered that the witness signatures display the same peculiar characteristics exhibited in the handwriting of Father Nathaniel Roland from the days of his youth. So the conclusion is, Neil Roland forged the witness signatures on both wills that he left to his sons. And when Neil expresses some dismay at having missed it, Peter points out that Neil didn't know that Nathaniel Roland was ambidextrous. The implication being that Neil is not only excused for not catching it, but that he might very well have caught it had he known that Roland was ambidextrous. So Peter's letting Neil off the hook, and by extension telling Neil, hey, let yourself off the hook. Yeah, that's a nice thing. Nice gesture. Peter also points out that the names of the signatures, Horace Bythe and Hatch O'Bray, are a bit odd, and they're fake, which really shouldn't be surprising since Nathaniel Roland forged them. After all, if he's going to forge the witness signatures for reasons as of yet unknown, why bother using the names of real people? Fake signatures deserve fake names. As they are looking at the wills and discussing them, Neil pauses, then notes that both Horace Bythe and Hatch O'Bray are comprised of exactly the same letters. He concludes that the names might be anagrams. Peter and Neil both grab notepads and begin to puzzle out various names that could be created from those anagrammed names. Both eventually, and pretty much simultaneously, arrive at Tycho Brahe. Peter wonders out loud what sort of message Roland was leaving behind for his sons. Neil is holding the wills, one in each hand, comparing the text, and notes that The father closed both wills with the line, "In the end, there should be nothing between you, which is everything." But also as he's looking at them, something about them strikes him. He gets up, walks toward the window, and holding the two wills up to the light that's coming in from the window, lays one on top of the other. He indicates to Peter what seems to be watermarks in the paper, saying, "They look like streets." And the illustration in the lower right-hand corner of each, which had carefully been hidden from our sight as viewers up to this point, create a compass rose when overlaid one on top of the other. Neil concludes that the phony wills, the forged signatures, the faked names of the witnesses, aren't the message at all. They're a map. We have another time jump, and then we see Neil arriving back at the FBI offices, probably the next day, or at least certainly later that day after having left. And as he enters, he spots an attractive young blonde woman walking up the stairs from the bullpen to the upper deck. Neil approaches Jones and asks who she is. Jones tells Neil, don't bother, I've already tried, meaning he's already tried hitting on her. Neil recognizes that she is with Art Crimes Department out of Washington, D.C., and when Jones asks him, why do you say that? Neil says that her attaché case is from the Smithsonian and that it is the gift of choice from the D.C. Art Crimes Chief to new recruits. That's a curious bit of knowledge for him to have. This doesn't seem like the sort of thing one would simply learn from browsing the internet or asking a few people. It suggests that he has previously had sufficient contact with somebody in that division to have learned this. Now, since we have not seen him have this sort of contact with Art Crimes during the course of the series, this raises a question. What prior scheme brought Neil into close enough contact with a member of the Art Crimes team that he was able to learn this information? And it makes me think that if no one has done it before, this might be something for somebody who's a fan fiction author to consider adding as part of a prequel story. Anyway, Neil asks Jones what case they've got that would involve DC Art Crimes, but Jones gives the classic answer that it's above his pay grade. We move to Peter's office, where we learn that he and the young woman's boss are old friends. We also learn that her boss gave her a rather detailed briefing of the situation that Peter is handing over to her, although we also learn that he wasn't supposed to brief her, or at least not in the detail that he apparently did. But since she's going to be investigating for Peter, she would have had to know some of the details. So ultimately, he would have given her many, most, maybe all the details that she apparently already knows. So why was he concerned about it? It may be that he didn't want her to know everything yet. The fact that she was already briefed before talking to Peter means that there was the possibility that she could have let something slip to someone in the intervening time, something that Peter doesn't want known outside the small circle of people he's already enlisting in this investigation. And he even tells her he doesn't have enough yet to open a formal investigation, but he wants to keep the number of people who are familiar with it, who have knowledge about it, very limited. So I think that's really the reason why he was a little bit irritated that his friend had briefed this young woman. Anyway, Peter briefs her on some details that she may not have been aware of, certainly that she didn't indicate being aware of, such as the fact that a partial manifest survived the fire. And as the sound of their conversation fades into the background, we see Neil at his desk, observing. He picks up one of Peter's business cards, gets up, leaves the bullpen, and walks out into the entryway that is outside the office doors. And he does this before the young woman can see him as she's leaving Peter's office. She exits the bullpen, walks into that outer area where Neil is at, and approaches the elevator. And as she does that, Neil approaches her as if he's a stranger needing assistance. He asks her a few questions, trying subtly to get her to reveal any information that he can use, but she's cagey and tries not to give him anything, although she does confirm that she is with DC Art Crimes. Neil seems to realize he's not going to get much more out of her, so he flashes Peter's business card and asks the young woman if she knows where he can find Agent Peter Burke. She helpfully points out Peter, and when Neil thanks her, put that in sarcasm quotes, for her help, he's able to get something useful from her. Her name is Agent Melissa Matthews. Neil walks back into the office and tells Jones, who had been watching the exchange, but of course was unable to hear the content of the exchange. He tells Jones, "Yep, you're right. I got nothing." Peter, who's come down from the upper deck, greets Neil with a noticeable sense of elation, telling Neil that they're going to go see the Roland brothers and tell them about the map. Neil comments on Peter's attitude, calling him giddy. And when Peter says he loves puzzles, Neil says, yes, he's seen the 3 New York Puzzlethon trophies. And Peter corrects him and says, no, it's 4. I did an internet search and I didn't find anything called a New York Puzzlethon, which doesn't mean it doesn't exist, only means that I didn't find any reference to it. But that's not at all surprising because I'm not exactly an internet search wizard. But Puzzlethons do exist and are basically just big get-togethers where a group of people work on puzzles, whether they be jigsaw puzzles, crosswords, Sudokus, word searches, whatever. The Puzzlethons can be informal events or organized, often charity events, particularly for autism fundraisers and awareness, and anything in between. And the reason Puzzlethons are associated very commonly with autism fundraisers and awareness is because the puzzle piece has been used as a symbol of autism awareness since 1963 by the National Autism Society in the UK, and since 1999 by the Autism Society of America in America. Back at the Roland Estate, Peter's explaining to the brothers about the wills and the images in the lower corners. Josh recognizes the combination image as the sundial in Le Monde Garden. James responds that they haven't done one of those, a treasure hunt, in years. James seems to be at least briefly entertaining the idea of pursuing the clues of the map, although he doesn't say so specifically. But Josh makes his feelings very, very clear by telling James, I'll see you in court. As Josh walks out, James does make an excuse for his brother, but then too dismisses the idea of pursuing the clues. When Neil suggests that the real will may be at the end of the hunt, James doesn't seem too convinced on that point. He then makes excuses for himself, saying he's got to go because his daughter will be home soon, and besides, the brothers no longer have to play the game set out by their father, or play by his rules. After he leaves, Neil and Peter are left alone in the dining room, and Neil asks what their next move is. Peter says, no move. They just log the copies of the wills into evidence and return them to the lawyers. But Neil tries to entice Peter into checking out the sundial.
You're not even a little bit curious about solving this puzzle?
Of course I am, but, you know, the assistant director hasn't authorized an FBI treasure hunting unit.
Why don't we drop by the park? Just to make sure nothing illicit is afoot at the sundial.
I can't. I have lunch with Elle, but you can take a look.
You don't want to come?
Yes.
I could use your astronomical puzzling expertise.
No, I can't. I can't. Next time. Just, you know. Keep me updated.
Blessing and a curse. He really does want to know what's going on with the puzzle, but it leads to, well, we'll get there. Next, having gotten Peter's blessing to pursue the puzzle, we see that Neil has brought Mozzie with him to visit the sundial. Neil tells Mozzie that he thinks the numbers across the bottom of the wheel might be times a day. Mozzie surveys a line off of the sundial based on that first time, but concludes that it doesn't seem to point to anything. Neil comments that everything points to something, so Neil concludes that they're missing something. Meanwhile, Peter is at home with Elizabeth, and they're eating dinner. Elizabeth had interviewed for a job at the DeArmet Gallery, and Peter is trying to be interested in hearing about the job and her interview. But he's having a bit of trouble staying focused. But remember what I said about keep me informed being kind of a good news, bad news thing? Yeah, he's having a little trouble staying focused.
How'd it go at the gallery?
Good.
Yeah?
Yeah, they're looking for a consultant. So I don't know, I was thinking.
Wow.
Wow?
No, I was wowing your news. I don't need to answer that.
Judy, if it's work.
That's nothing. So, could you consult at the gallery and still do Burke events?
Yeah, I think I could do both, and besides, I could do my own openings. I don't know. I mean, what does Neil want?
Nothing. He's on this treasure hunt.
A real treasure hunt?
Yeah. An eccentric millionaire left coded wills to his kids. Boring.
It's from Neil.
It is?
Yeah. All right, he said he's found nothing obvious in the Times, but the sun won't shine on the gnomon for 4 more hours. Thoughts? You just happen to have the will in your back pocket?
Yeah, be prepared. Eagle Scout.
Of course.
All right, see, there's this little flower right next to the first time on the will. What do you think it means?
Well, it's a tulip, which is symbolic for rebirth, springtime.
That's it. The angle of the sun is going to be different in the spring rather than the winter or the summer. So the shadow on the sundial is going to be different. They could recreate it using a couple mirrors.
But that doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
Honey.
What?
Do you want to grab some mirrors and go play with Neil?
Yes.
Two things here. First, we've discussed in the past how Peter has had trouble being the sort of husband that he wants to be for Elizabeth, about how he has trouble being romantic. Now, he has improved, but obviously he still has a way to go. He's still a work in progress. Yes, he's making the effort to be interested in what Elizabeth has to say, in her career, in her business, but try as he might, he can't stay focused on what she's saying. Sure, Neil keeps sending texts, and that isn't helping, but he's clearly already preoccupied with the treasure hunt. Otherwise, he would not be so distracted every time a text message from Neil comes in. And each time Elizabeth asks or says something about it, he sounds more and more like he's trying to convince himself rather than her that he's not interested. And when she asks if he wants to go grab some mirrors and go play with Neil, she isn't angry, she isn't resentful or bitter or even mildly upset that she didn't get to finish telling him about her interview. And second, we once again see that Elizabeth plays a critical role in helping in Peter's investigations. Sure, Peter might probably have gotten the answer eventually. Of course, there's no guarantee. But because of Elizabeth's insight, he gets to the solution sooner rather than later, or not at all. And tying those two things together, again, we see that she participates willingly, even enthusiastically, and as I've already said, without resentment of his distraction, which interfered with her sharing her news. Well, back at the park, Neil and Mozzie are waiting for Peter. Neil tells Mozzie about Matthews. Mozzie is understandably concerned, since art crimes is one of the reasons that Neil is with the FBI. Neil kind of dismisses it, saying, it could just be nothing, to which Mozzie responds with the same line that Neil gave him earlier. Everything points to something. The only silver lining here is that Matthew doesn't leave until the end of the week, which gives them time to figure out what's up. Mozzie begins to talk about the buyer that he has lined up for the Degas, but he's cut short with Peter and Elizabeth's arrival. Peter explains that the symbols next to the time probably represent seasons. Knowing this will allow them to calculate and simulate the proper sun angles to the sundial without having to wait through all four seasons. Peter's brought mirrors and a sextant to help them with the simulations, and there's a nice little exchange between Peter and Elizabeth about the sextant. The four of them run through the times on the wheels and calculate that the code it hides is BSH. Great, they've solved the code. But now they have to solve the solution, because BSH doesn't mean anything to any of them that they can think of. And as they are contemplating that puzzle, Jones calls. He tells Peter that the treasure hunt has taken a dark turn. Savannah Rowland has been kidnapped. At the FBI offices, Diana and Clinton are bringing Peter up to speed. Cybercrimes and the kidnapping squad are setting up a command center at the Rowland estate. James is there. Josh is in the interview room next door, and the ransom is due in less than 6 hours, with the kidnappers live streaming a video of Savannah via a website. The website, kidnapsavannah.com, indicates that this has been well planned. The website is hidden behind firewalls and other obfuscations, indicating that their suspect is highly tech savvy. Because Savannah appears to be in good spirits and not aware of the camera, they deduce that the kidnapper is probably someone she knows. The ransom demand, provided via the website, is $6.4 million. Curiously, the exact value of the Rowland estate, meaning that the kidnapper has seen the will. Peter points out that this means that the kidnapping is personal. Now, I don't know about you, but at this point, I was thinking Josh was in the frame for it. I didn't really want it to be him behind the kidnapping, but that's where my thoughts went. Next, we see that Peter is obviously thinking the same thing, because he's questioning brother Josh, and he's questioning him as if he had something to do with it. Josh says no one in the family would do that, because Savannah is, quite frankly, the only thing keeping the family together, or as much together as it is at any rate. Josh realizes that if they can find the will, they can pay the ransom. Neil tells him, hey, look, we've already started the search. We've been to the sundial. It gave us the letters BSH. but we don't know what that means. Josh says that was his father's favorite acronym, although it's not actually an acronym, since an acronym is an abbreviation that is formed from the initial letters of words that are then pronounced as a word. Anyway, he tells them that it means Big Sky Hunting, which was what their father called taking the brothers to the planetarium. Josh says he wants to go to the planetarium to follow up on the clue, but Peter tells him that the best thing he can do to help them is to help his brother build a suspect profile as quickly as possible. At the planetarium, Peter and Neil meet Felix, the receptionist, for want of a better word. He tells them that the last time they saw Nathaniel Rowland at the planetarium was 2 p.m. on December 3rd, stating that it was a big deal when Mr. Rowland stopped by. But Felix can't find where Mr. Rowland signed in, and everybody has to sign in, and he knows that Mr. Rowland signed in. Neil looks at the visitor log and finds the name Tycho Brahe, with the comment, "Happy birthday to me." Felix comments offhandedly, "December 14th, 1546 is Tycho Brahe's birthday." I think it's interesting that they had Nathaniel Rowland coming in on 3 December, but referencing Tycho Brahe's birthday as being on 14 December, just 11 days later. Why wouldn't Rowland have gone in on the 14th, thereby tying not only his comment, but also the date of his visit to Brahe's birthday? Was there something that was cut out of the episode that we didn't see? Or was this some weird quirk in the puzzle? I don't know. It doesn't make any sense to me. Seems to me it could have been a better clue if he had been there on the 14th and not the 3rd. But anyway, inside the planetarium proper, Felix runs the Starscape projector and backdates the display to 1592. Wait a minute. 1592? Why 1592? Why 1592 if his birth date was 1546? Which one are we interested in? His birth date or 1592? And what's the significance of 1592 in Brahe's life? The only significance I can find to that year is that apparently that was the year that Brahe launched an attack on fellow astronomer Nicholas Reimarus. Brahe and Reimarus apparently didn't get along real well. They were in competition with each other. They had published books at about the same time. Brahe was a swaggering aristocrat with a silver nose and a reputation for debauchery, whereas Reimarus was a commoner who, as a child, had been a pig herder. Brahe was a dyed-in-the-wool aristocrat who avoided marrying a woman because she was a commoner, despite the fact that they lived together for 30 years and had 8 children. So it would seem that Brahe looked down his nose at Reimarus because of his lack of social stature. And in this case, the phrase looking down his nose is somewhat ironic and a joke, in that Brahe had actually lost part of his nose in a duel with his third cousin over a difference in their appraisal of a mathematical formula. But the Brahe-Reimarus feud does not really seem to have any bearing on the scene. So back to my question, why 1592? I have no answer. Maybe it's in there and I missed it, but I don't know what it is. Okay, so now they have the night sky as Brahe would have seen it in 1592. But what does it mean? Neil recalls that in his will, Rowland talks about big sky hunting with his favorite twins. Since Josh and James aren't twins, Peter asks Felix to highlight the Gemini twins. But it turns out that one of the Gemini twins is missing from the sky. One is below the horizon. So the constellation isn't a clue, or at least it's not the clue that they were looking for. Or at least not directly. The missing twin in the sky leads the conversation to the fact that Brahe had a twin brother who died shortly after his birth, and that Brahe had written a letter to his missing twin, a copy of which was included in the first printed copy of Brahe's collected works, which the planetarium just happens to have on display, which just happened to have been donated to the planetarium by none other than Nathaniel Rowland. Felix takes the pair of them to the Tycho Brahe exhibit room and shows them the book which contains the letter. It's in a case on the table. Their host tells them that the letter Brahe wrote to his brother is on page 273. Peter and Neil wait for Felix to turn the book to the page in question, but he doesn't seem to be inclined to do much of anything. He just stands there. When they ask him to flip the book to the page in question, he tells them, "Oh no, that's not possible." The pages are turned by a mechanical arm, one page every hour until the last page is reached, at which time the process reverses. There is no manual override for the mechanism. The case is made of half-inch glass and sealed to control the air pressure, the temperature, and the humidity inside the case to preserve the paper. In short, although Felix understands the situation and the possible importance of whatever's on page 273, there's simply nothing any of them can do about it to get access to page 273, short of destroying the case and possibly the book inside. Felix does suggest an alternative, however. They could come back in a few days. As Peter and Neil leave the planetarium, Peter gets a call from Diana. She's got a lead, a seemingly solid lead. So Peter's going to go back to the FBI to meet with her, and he's leaving the clue to page 273 and the pursuit of the treasure in Neil's hands. Neil's a bit surprised. I think he's reacting to the lack of trust that Peter has expressed recently in him regarding the sub-treasure. But Peter assures him that right now the important thing is to get Savannah back. Now, despite Peter's distrust of Neil with regard to the sub-treasure, Neil has demonstrated that, despite being a thief, he has a deep sense of protectiveness toward children. We saw it earlier in Vital Signs when June's granddaughter's life was in danger, and in the episode In the Red when he was working to help catch the turns-out-to-be desperate mother-turned-jewel thief, Catherine McMillan, and in the process realized that there was a child in the middle of the FBI takedown. So despite his anger and distrust of Neil in other respects, Peter realizes that in this case, Neil can absolutely be trusted, and perhaps even be trusted to bend the rules just enough to make sure they get Savannah back. And by doing so without Peter's knowledge, it gives Peter plausible deniability. We jump to Neil's apartment where we see Mozzie and Neil trying to figure out how to get a look at page 273. Mozzie sums up the situation fairly well. It sounds simple enough. It seems completely possible, and yet completely impossible. The only part of Mozzie's conclusion that Neil disputes is that it's simple, saying that it's a centuries-old book written to a man's dead twin brother, donated by an equally eccentric, recently deceased, modern-day Howard Hughes as part of a posthumous treasure hunt. Yeah, like Mozzie said, simple, only not. And as they are discussing the possibilities, we see the countdown clock on the website shows that they only have 3 more hours to go. Mozzie throws out several suggestions, something called the Cannonball, something called the Lazy Susan, but we're not giving any details of what those schemes would entail, just that they won't work under the circumstances. Mozzie comments on the alarm system utilized on the display, and Neil realizes that the rest of the planetarium utilizes the same alarm system, which tells him that there's probably a single access code for all the components of the system, which means they can use something called the blind man's bluff, which means they need a dog. And naturally, they think of Satchmo. At the FBI, Diana is telling Peter about her lead, a man named Brett Gellis, security expert responsible for the Roland security system, tech savvy, has a relationship with Savannah as the guy who keeps her safe. His business has collapsed, and he's in serious financial trouble. And they can't find him. He's not at his home. He doesn't have an office. But wherever he's keeping Savannah, it's someplace that she feels comfortable and he feels safe having her. Peter has the idea that maybe it's a home on which Gellis had previously done security work, so he tells Jones to work up a list of any of Gellis's previous clients that are out of town. And we see from the website timer that there are only 2 hours, 24 minutes left before the deadline. At the planetarium, we see Neil dressed in the same type of a red jacket that we saw earlier on Felix, the planetary receptionist. And as he walks through the planetarium lobby, carefully avoiding being seen by Felix, we also see that he has some dog treats or something that would be appealing to a dog in his hand. Next, we see Mozzie and Satchmo. Satchmo is wearing a harness and a jacket that reads Guide Dog. Mozzie is holding onto Satchmo's harness, wearing dark glasses, and holding his head up, not looking at anything specific, pretending to be blind. Thus, blind man's bluff. Neil walks by the reception desk while Felix is turned away, and he drops the dog treats into the document slot at the top of the desk. Neil walks over to the entrance of the Roland wing of the planetarium, home of the Tycho Brahe exhibit, and announces to everyone there that, sorry, but the exhibit's closed for the rest of the afternoon. As Neil takes off up the stairs and the crowd starts to disperse, an unidentified man approaches Mozzie, undoubtedly wondering what a blind man is doing at a planetarium. Mozzie says he likes the idea of stars, which, despite sounding merely like a Mozzieism, is actually a pretty reasonable comment. After all, just because a person can't see something doesn't mean that they can't appreciate it in other ways, including conceptually. A moment later, Mozzie turns Satchmo loose. Naturally, Satchmo starts zeroing in on the dog treats that Neil had left. And naturally, Mozzie starts calling out to anyone who would listen. But really, for Felix's benefit, that he's lost his guide dog. Felix comes to Mozzie's rescue, and put that in sarcasm quotes, telling him that Satchmo is in his office. Then he leads Mozzie over to the office to recover Satchmo. Felix enters the access code to the office on the keypad, which Mozzie observes. I did have one question, though. If the door was closed and locked, how did Satchmo get in? Well, presumably the door was left open. But why? It's a door to what is presumably some sort of a secured area, and we know this by virtue of the fact that it has a security lock on the door. So why would you walk out and just leave the door open? You wouldn't. You'd close it. But let's say that he did. Let's say he did walk out of the office and leave the door open. Did Satchmo close the door behind him when he walked in? That's a pretty neat trick for a dog, if he did that. I'm not saying that a dog couldn't do that, but there's no reason why a dog would do that, unless he was specifically trained to do that for some reason, and I don't think Satchmo was trained to do that. So, minor little detail I don't understand. Another minor little detail I don't understand, let's put it that way. Anyway, upstairs, Neil has entered the exhibit room where the book is at. He unrolls his tool pack, reads the text that Mozzie sent him with the access code, puts on gloves to conceal his fingerprints, unlocks the housing beneath the table with the code, and this is the housing that contains the actuator mechanism. Then he sets about activating the mechanism to turn the pages of the book. Back at the FBI, Peter is given the results of the research into Gellis. Of the 22 homes where he has installed security systems, 4 have owners that are on vacation somewhere, leaving the houses temporarily unoccupied. Peter tells Jones and Diana to send teams to sit on the 4 homes. Savannah isn't in any immediate danger, and he doesn't want to move too quickly and end up turning it into a hostage situation as a result of tipping their hand too early. But he does tell them that he wants to know immediately if they see any signs of movement inside of any of the homes. Back at the planetarium, Mozzie joins Neil in the exhibit room. They briefly discuss Agent Melissa Matthews, with Neil commenting that she's in town for one more day and that she doesn't know who Neil is. Mozzie suggests the traveling salesman. 2 things. First, again, we only get the scheme by name with no details. Second, how would Agent Matthews not know who Neil was? I suppose she could be fairly new to the DC Art Crimes group. She would have to be to at least not be aware of the fact that Neil Caffrey, master forger and art criminal, is working as a consultant for Peter Burke. But it also means that she didn't do any sort of research before coming to New York. So I'm going to conclude that she's a new agent. She has a lot to learn. Mozzie is watching Neil's progress on flipping the pages of the book. He watches as the mechanism flips the pages to page, not 273. The mechanism has skipped. Neil comments that that's the first time that it skipped, and he reverses the process and tries it again. This time, the mechanism turns to not page 273. Mozzie gives Neil grief for missing the page, and Neil's response is a bit testy, which seems a bit unusual for Neil. True, he and Mozzie often razz each other and even have stronger disagreements, but it isn't very often he's actually genuinely testy with Mozzie, which seems to suggest that he's a bit stressed. In the middle of all this, Mozzie gets a text. He tells Neil, good news. Things are all set for him to fence the Degas that evening. Again, Neil's response is testy and somewhat sarcastic. Yeah, right, good news. Now, can we please handle the book? We don't have time for this other stuff. Yeah, testy. Mozzie bends down, looks at the mechanism, and announces, we need to cut a hole. My question is, what did Mozzie see that Neil didn't? Or what did he recognize the significance of that Neil didn't? We don't know, but obviously there was something. They pull out the tools that they'll need to drill a hole and a pointer to turn the book to page 273. As they are preparing to drill the hole, Mozzie declares, if this doesn't work, we blame the dog. Poor Satchmo. Because as soon as they get the hole drilled, air starts rushing into the case. And as it does, The pages of the book begin disintegrating until there's nothing left but a pile of powder on top of the cover and binding. Back at the FBI, Peter is giving Neil the what for. He's not only upset that Neil went too far and ended up destroying the book, and that the planetarium is going to prosecute, not to mention giving Peter and the FBI a bad name, which of course Peter didn't mention. He's also upset that Neil made Satchmo an accomplice to a robbery. Neil makes a joke about how the book is now light reading, but that doesn't go over well. So then Neil defends himself by saying, look, the fact that the book disintegrated proves it was a fake. He says Brahe lived on an island, that he ran his own paper mill, made his own paper primarily from tulip tree stock, which has a very low acidic content, and that the real manuscript could be left in a Turkish bathhouse without risk of harm, whereas the one from the planetarium turned into a shrinky-dink the second the air hit it. Now, I was able to find reference to Brahe having his own paper mill, so at least some of the information given here about Brahe is true. Whether or not he used tulip tree pulp, whether or not it has a low acidic content, and whether or not the real manuscript could be left in a Turkish bathhouse without risk of harm is unverified at this point. As far as shrinky dinks go, in case you're not familiar with those, they are a real thing, and they were real popular back in like the 1980s. Shrinky dinks start out as a blank sheet of polystyrene plastic, which could be colored with felt tip pens, acrylic paints, colored pencils, and so on. Or they could be purchased with pre-printed outlines of popular children's characters and other subjects, which are then colored in. After creating the image on the plastic, they would be cut into shapes roughly matching the outline of the image that had been colored on them, after which they would be placed in an oven at moderate heat for a period of time. And under the heat, the plastic would shrink to roughly 2/3 of the original size, but would also become nearly 10 times thicker. After they had shrunk and cooled, they could be used for a variety of things such as charms, pins, window decorations, and more. And they are still available. Back in the episode, after Neil explains why the book is a fake, Diana suggests that Roland may have intended for the book to be destroyed. The book cover is sitting on Peter's desk, and he notices the symbols on the inside of the spine. He says he's seen those before, on Savannah's anklet, which was given to her by her grandfather. This prompts Neil to conclude that Savannah must be their next clue. Jones comes in and reports that the power company shows increased power usage at one of the homes that they had under surveillance. So Peter sends Diana to the scene and directs Clinton to stay with the brothers at the command center. Peter says that Gellis has to make contact with someone about the ransom drop soon, but that it could be a problem if he's in the house with Savannah. So Neil has an idea how to separate Gellis from Savannah. Tell him that James doesn't have the money and won't until they solve the treasure hunt. And surprise, surprise, Savannah's anklet is a vital clue in the hunt. So we need Savannah, or at least her anklet. We see that the website timer has dropped to less than 1 hour, and that we are at the Roland house, which is the command center. The brothers are there, Peter and Neil are there, and a host of other FBI agents. Gellis calls, and Neil answers the phone. Gellis wants to talk to James Roland, but Neil says no. He says he's James Roland's attorney, and he explains that the elder Roland had left what Neil terms a rather unorthodox will, that the money is not going to be available to James Roland until they unlock the puzzle, and that the anklet Savannah is wearing is a vital clue to the solution. Gellis balks, saying he's not going to turn over Savannah. Neil says, fine, just bring the anklet. Gellis says, no, he's not an idiot. He's not going to play that game. Neil reveals that they, he conveniently doesn't define who they is, nor does Gellis think to ask. They know from the video feed that Gellis doesn't want to hurt Savannah, and Neil assures him that the brothers just want to settle the issue quietly and without fuss. He assures Gellis that if he brings the anklet, he's going to get his money. Gellis responds by hanging up, not having said anything. James is understandably concerned, but Neil assures him that it's really not a problem. They just caught Gellis off guard, and he needs a little time to formulate a new plan. But then we see the website timer suddenly run to zero in a matter of seconds, and the video of Savannah goes black. And James kind of loses it. He understandably interprets the clock running to zero as a sign that he'll never see his daughter alive again. And I think any of us under those circumstances, would jump to that conclusion. Then, in what looks to be perhaps the first sign of a reconciliation, Brother Josh goes to Brother James and puts his hand on his shoulder. Next, we see that Peter is outside of one of the homes that the FBI has been watching, the one that had the unusual power usage. But it's starting to look like that report was a false lead. Turns out that it was probably just the air conditioner coming on. Peter directs Diana to have the team back at the FBI offices go over every detail, every receipt, every phone call, every communication, everything, anything, something that will tell them all the places that Gellis has been in the last few months. Back at the Roland house, it's noisily quiet. Everyone is busy. Many people are talking, but it's all background noise to everybody because nothing else seems to be happening. Suddenly, Gellis walks in, saying, "Hey, I don't need to hide anymore since you all know who I am." James starts to rush him, but everyone rushes to stop him from rushing Gellis. After all, it won't help for him to attack Gellis, and it likely could turn out to be bad. At the same time, everybody is tussling with James. Gellis holds up both the anklet from Savannah's ankle and his phone, which has the video feed showing Savannah playing. From the phone, we hear her calling for her father and her Uncle Josh. Gellis seems to be holding all the cards, so he raises the bet, telling them that he's their only hope for seeing Savannah again. He's the only one who knows where she's at, and that he's not going to tell anybody anything about where she's at until he gets his money, and that if anything happens to him, Savannah's going to die, and they're going to be able to stand there and watch and not be able to do anything about it. He demands that the FBI personnel all leave. They do, leaving Gellis and the brothers, but Neil insists on staying. Gellis calls him the guy on the phone and tosses Neil the anklet and demands, "Find my money." James is not doing well. He's understandably angry, which in some ways may not be better than being scared, but on the other hand, being scared might immobilize him, whereas being angry will at least give him motivation to do something. It's just that something needs to be directed towards something more useful than just grabbing Gellis by the throat and strangling him. Brother Josh steps in to help with that guidance, telling James that they can do this, saying that it's just like one of those scavenger hunts that their father would have them do when they were 10. Neil describes the anklet to the brothers. There's a sun and a moon charm at each end, and in between are charms of a bicycle, a tennis racket, and a camera. He challenges the brothers to think about what they mean. Josh says there was a Christmas when he got a bike and James got a tennis racket. At first, they don't recall anything about a camera, but James then remembers that their father had gotten a camera and had taken a picture of the boys. Neil asks where the picture is, but the brothers don't know. Gellis orders them, find it. While the brothers are off looking for the photo, Neil begins goading Gellis, and Gellis tells Neil his story.
"You can't touch me."
"Oh, yeah, I'm sure you got it all under control. What could possibly go wrong? The old man forged the wills. We have no idea where the real ones are. How much he even left these guys?"
"Oh, come on. He left them plenty. I knew him."
"And how could you do this to his family?"
"I came to him about a year ago. I told him I have money problems. And I need help. And you know what he said to me? He said, make a plan, see it through. Make a plan, see it through. Advice taken."
"The crime isn't the hard part. Hard part's getting away with it. You see, you never know how an investigation's gonna go. Or what little clues you might accidentally leave behind. I hope you learn to sleep with one eye open."
Neil starts out by trying to set Gellis off balance. But then it gets personal because after Gellis tells Neil his story, Neil begins telling Gellis his story. He doesn't identify it as his story. So Gellis doesn't really realize the significance of what Neil's saying. But of course we do. We recognize that Neil is revealing the part of his life as a criminal that lives beneath the falsely glamorous surface of the easy money, the easy things, the easy lifestyle. He's telling Gellis his own personal experience as a warning. I think this is a significant moment because it clearly shows what has been hinted at up to this point. Maybe that Neil is starting to realize that even while he was living the life and enjoying it, there was still an unacknowledged and constant undercurrent of worry about how it could all go wrong. A worry that he doesn't have anymore, for the most part. He's starting to see these things. We jump to Peter and Diana. Diana is still at the FBI with her team. Peter is on the road, and Diana is giving him an address. Gellis had deposited a check into his bank for an off-the-books job at that address. The home is for sale, has been occupied for at least a month, and Peter says he's headed there and will be there in 5 minutes, so send backup. Back at the Roland house, the brothers have found the photograph, or rather, two halves of the photograph. Their father had cut it into two pieces and hung each piece on the opposing sides of a dividing wall in the middle of a room. But there's nothing in the photos that seems significant. There's nothing on the back of the photos. There's nothing on the wall surfaces beneath them. Nothing. Neil recognizes that the two pieces are mounted at exactly the same spot on the wall, exactly opposite each other. He comments about the last line of the will, which was exactly the same in both. When it's all said and done, there shouldn't be anything between you, which is everything. Neil taps on the wall at the spot where one of the photos was and says, they need to look inside. James says, no, not going to happen, not until we know where Savannah is. Gellis ignores James and orders them to break open the wall. Now, Josh, once again guiding his brother, calms James down. After all, they either have to keep Gellis on the line in order to give the FBI the time that they need to find Savannah, or they need to keep Gellis from doing something stupid and fatal until he gives her up. While this is all going on with the brothers and Neil, Peter and a team of agents has entered the property that Diana had pinpointed. They make their way up multiple floors, searching through apartments until they find the apartment where Savannah has been held. Once they have her, Peter sends Jones a text. We have Savannah. In the Roland house, the brothers are preparing to tear open the wall when Jones and a group of agents appear, and Jones announces, Brett Gellis, you're under arrest. Gellis, thinking he still holds the winning hand, calls, thinking that they're bluffing. But Gellis hasn't been paying attention to the video feed. Neil holds up his phone and shows Gellis what he's missed. Peter picking up Savannah and telling her, your daddy's watching. You want to say hi to him? We have a time jump, and we see Peter bringing Savannah into the dining room where he puts her down and she runs to her father. Peter and Neil are off to the side talking. They congratulate each other on a job well done. Then Peter asks what they found hidden in the wall. Neil admits that they didn't get that far before Jones came in and arrested Gellis. Next, we see the brothers tearing into the wall. They find a large metal box, which they remove from the wall, open it, and find the genuine copy of Brahe's book and the real will. Later, back in Peter's office, Neil is saying that the brothers donated their father's entire Brahe collection to the planetarium and that they are both invited to the opening. After a bit of good-natured ribbing between the two of them, Neil begins to leave. As he's walking out the door, Peter tells him, it's good to be back to normal. Peter seems sincere. Neil seems slightly uncomfortable. It's understandable that Neil would not consider them being back to normal since he realizes that Peter is suspicious about the sub-treasure and is clearly investigating. But why would Peter seem to have been sincere about his sentiment considering his suspicions about Neil and the sub-treasure? I'm thinking it's more about what Peter wants to see rather than what he's actually looking at. He is suspicious of Neil's involvement in the sub-treasure, but he doesn't want to believe it. At some level, he doesn't want to believe it. And he's taking their success in this case and the way the two of them work together on it as a sign that things really are right with the world and with Neil. We have a time jump and see Neil at the table in his apartment. First, we see him looking at the treasure cam. Then we see him working on what appears to be a fake police ID wallet. Then we see him studying a file on Agent Melissa Matthews. Later, Neil meets Mozzie at a hotel bar where Mozzie has been watching Agent Matthews for Neil. Mozzie says that Matthews is two martinis in and that he's going to leave to go sell the Degas. Neil walks over and sits down near Matthews as if he didn't see and recognize her. She looks up, looks at Neil, recognizes him, and they greet each other. Small talk ensues, and Neil introduces himself as Chris Gates. The small talk continues with Neil saying he's on his way to Paris. He pulls out the wallet that we saw him creating earlier so he can get his money to pay for his drink, and making sure that Matthews can see the badge that identifies him as U.S. Special Agent for Interpol. She asks him what division he's with, and of course he says, art crimes. We jump forward and we see that they're still talking after what has presumably been quite some time, and Neil comments that he's sure that she is there for the same reason that he is, but of course he can't talk about it, and he's sure that Agent Burke told her the same thing. But she's curious and decides that they should play the game of, we both say it on three. Neil pretends to reject the idea and then pretends to come around. They both count to three, and Neil starts to say, Nazi sub. But of course, Agent Matthews cheated and didn't say anything. They have a giggle and a laugh about how Neil got suckered. Then, thinking that Neil knows what she knows, Matthew says the idea that all that art might be still out there floating around is incredible, and that even though they only have a partial manifest, that's all it's going to take, is for someone to sell even a single thing on that portion that they have, and they'll nail them. Neil excuses himself, saying he'll be back in a minute. He pulls out his phone, and he dials.
Mozzie, where are you? You cannot, I repeat, you cannot sell the piece. We got a big problem.
That brings us to the end of this episode. I would like to remind you that on the website, which is at www.whitecollaredpc.com, you will find the show notes and links to resources I've used in preparing this episode. Additionally, you will also find ways that you can help support the show with either one-time donations or a monthly donation, which will help cover the costs of keeping this show online. I want to thank you for listening, and please be sure and join me for the next episode as I share my thoughts on Season 3, Episode 3, Deadline. Until then, take care and God bless.